As the Taliban settles into its new administration, hoisting its flag over the presidential palace over the weekend, it's announced women's education will be segregated, with subjects under review, and a new Islamic dress code introduced. The Taliban seized control from the elected government not quite a month ago, on August 15th. Since then, all women, except public health sector workers, have been told to stay away from work. Before the Taliban takeover, universities were co-educational, with men and women studying side by side. Female students didn't have to abide by a dress code. The new government has also replaced the Women's Affairs Ministry with a Ministry of Vice and Virtue. Meanwhile, the United Nations has warned up to 500,000 Afghans could flee the country by the end of the year. Almost 6 million are already displaced. The UN has asked neighbouring countries, such as Pakistan, to keep its borders open. My guest now is Afghan journalist Bilal Sawari, who was based in Kabul reporting on Afghanistan for 20 years. He's now safely in Canada with his family, having fled the country with a very heavy heart. Bilal joins me now from Toronto. Hi Bilal, how are you?
It's good to be with you, thank you.
And how are you and how are your family in Toronto?
We're good, thank you for asking. We're safe. We're 4 more days before we can basically finish our mandatory quarantine, but our hearts are still broken by the fact that we were forced to leave our homeland, our city, especially for my younger daughter, Sola, which we named her after peace, hoping that that is something we will eventually get. But instead, what we had was a destructive and devastating wave of attacks by Taliban attacking major provincial capitals. And eventually, they literally managed to take the city of Kabul without a single shot being fired. So our hopes were shattered. There was a climate of fear and uncertainty that prevailed. And since I have been able to leave, and I'm one of the very luckiest ones along with other of my colleagues, we now see how the Taliban soldiers and how the Taliban are treating, women demonstrators, how they've been beating up quite brutally some of my colleagues from Itlaat-e-Roz, which is one of Afghanistan's most prominent newspapers. So it is simply, heartbreaking to see what is happening inside Afghanistan.
So you had to leave because of your career as a journalist?
Well, I had to leave because I had visits by various Taliban fighters and commanders inquiring about me time and again. My office and my home were adjacent, close to each other. And eventually I, felt like the safety of my family and my safety were not guaranteed, but that I could also not continue working. Obviously, that is something that should never be taken lightly. If a Taliban fighter or commander comes and inquires about you, or if there's a knock on your door, because they're not coming to have a cup of green tea with you. They're coming with deadly consequences. Any number of things can happen to you. And we have heard from the Taliban, words, promises, nice words, but those words have not been matched by actions on the ground. And that lack of, not having a conducive environment to work, that climate of fear, that you will be imprisoned, that you will be tortured, that you could be taken away from your family. I think what made me eventually think to leave, a decision that was painful, was heartbreaking, because I've been all over the world. I studied in the United States as a frequent visitor to Europe and elsewhere, including to New Zealand. But I always felt that home was Kabul, that I was committed, along with my other colleagues, to be able to tell the world about Afghanistan and also Afghanistan about the world. And the mass exodus of the Afghan media family means that one of the biggest achievements of the last 20 years is gone. It literally vanished.
How were you able to leave? I mean, we saw these chaotic, traumatic scenes at the airport. So how difficult was it for you to leave once you made that decision?
I was informed by my colleagues and people who were helping to evacuate me that I had to leave for an undisclosed location, which was being later on identified as the Serena Hotel. And as I made that journey with my family, there was literally silence in the 4 or 5 minute drive that we had. Usually it would like take 30 minutes because of traffic jams, the chaotic traffic jams. And once I went into that hotel, you know, on my way to that hotel that I had known it so well, like the back of my hand, it was my city. I just felt like the weight of the entire world was sitting on my shoulder. My wife, my baby daughter, my parents, none of us said anything. And there were so many phone calls and WhatsApp messages from international media outlets asking me if I could do live interviews for them. Usually, I reply instantly. And on that day, I just felt like time stopped. Once we were inside the hotel for a few days, we were incredibly lucky, along with 150 of my other colleagues, mostly from media and civil society, to be evacuated by the Qatari embassy. The ambassador, a dynamic ambassador there, humble man, and took us in the middle of the night. You know, we drove, stopping at different Taliban checkpoints, first time coming across with them on the streets of Kabul. And then eventually we were flown to Doha after about like 13 hours of wait inside the airport. But all of us were heartbroken because none of us were at the airport covering the story, something that we had done for 20 years. This time we were there to leave. And I remember like walking to C-17 belonging to the Qatari Air Force. I cried, you know, my tears like started coming down from my eyes because I said a silent goodbye to my, you know, city, to my circle of friends, to my memories, to the energy that I had invested in that city. And before that, I bumped into Liz Doucette. She's been a longtime colleague of mine, and I spoke to her. She interviewed me, and it was probably one of the most painful interviews that I'd ever done. And to have all of your dreams, you know, buried, to have all of your aspirations gone in a matter of seconds, I think is the most painful thing. And we had experienced that reality as kids during the Civil War time. So on the plane, I remember looking at many different people who are household names in Afghanistan, especially on Tolo TV. There's, you know, this woman who was running the morning show, Bamdad Khosho, Good Morning. And, you know, millions of Afghans literally like lost their hopes and dreams and futures. And yeah, since then, it has been a life from scratch. We are here, we are beginning to build our lives, but no matter where we are, we will continue to give the Afghan people a voice and we will not give up on Afghanistan.
What are you hearing from Afghanis who have either chosen not to leave or have not been able to leave Afghanistan? What's life like now?
Well, some of our colleagues definitely have suffered the most. As you know, they were badly beaten up. The world saw those images. But a lot more of our friends and colleagues, not only from the media, they are in hiding. People have been fearing for their lives. I think the Taliban idea of basically providing amnesty to everyone, that, you know, there will be no retributions and revenge killings, is perhaps only words at the moment. And they have failed to basically deliver on it. So a generation of Afghans, they feel deeply, deeply betrayed by their own government and politicians, I mean the former government. But that betrayal in their hearts is also because of how the international community in the United States abandoned them. Remember, Joe Biden announced the withdrawal date for the American forces in the absence of a credible peace process or a comprehensive and permanent ceasefire. The U.S. and everyone else should have at least worked on the idea that Afghanistan should have that credible and meaningful peace process, which was never there. So Americans negotiated their own deal, which was an exit deal with the Taliban. It was a matter of time before everything crumbled. And look at the end result. It's an epic failure. Billions of dollars invested, blood and treasure invested by countries like Australia, like New Zealand, like, you know, the rest of the world. And the evacuation in the 11th hour was simply, you know, heartbreaking to see that everything that Afghans and the Americans and Europeans and Kiwis and Aussies have worked for, the end result was that. And now it is an Afghanistan under the Taliban. Taliban are more rigid. Taliban are more extreme. Taliban are more brutal. this myth that Taliban 2.0 is there is simply not true. So how the Taliban now transition from fighting into governance, how they can get legitimacy, how they can secure international funding, more importantly, how they can get the confidence of the Afghan people, I think looks to me like a massive challenge for them.
You've said that you would love for your daughter to be able to return to Afghanistan, go to school there one day. What are your thoughts on that? There have been quite a few announcements in the last few days, changes to the university and to the educational system, segregation coming back in, that kind of thing. What are the sort of freedoms that women have gained over the last 20 years that are now being lost?
Well, I would hope that for my daughter Sola, one day she would most importantly and painfully understand why we made that decision on her behalf to leave her homeland. Because I had always hoped that my daughter should go to school in Kabul, that she should do so in a peaceful Afghanistan. Obviously, you know, what you're looking at the moment in terms of Taliban limiting all the freedoms and, you know, they are introducing more harsher, you know, ways of life, is what the Taliban used to do during the 1990s, except that back then Afghanistan was not politically and socially transformed as it is today. You know, Afghans didn't have access to the internet back then. Now you have got majority of Afghans who are below the age of 25, I believe. We're one of the youngest countries, at least in Asia. So we will have to see how that works out as far as the Taliban regime is concerned. But I have my fears that the Afghan women are the one who will pay the most, more than anyone else, that their freedoms will not be there, their rights to education, rights to work. And that is a tragedy, because over the last 20 years, the Afghan women have paid a massive price, you know, to get where they are. Obviously, that is not how the reality was for millions of women in rural areas. But if they had a chance, if they were told that do you want to go to school or university, you want to work, I'm sure those women would have said yes. And what I look at Afghanistan today is the repeat of Afghanistan of the 1990s in many different ways. And perhaps in the months to come, we might see the Taliban, you know, getting even more harsher, and they might get even more brutal, because at the moment there is so much attention and focus on Afghanistan, at least in terms of international media, that's presence, and Afghans at the moment to have access to internet and social media.
What do you see as the likely relationship between the Taliban and the international community? Certainly they are media and social media savvy this time around, so it feels a little different. But ultimately, do you think that there will be, or they will need, cooperation with the international community?
I would like to divide the Taliban into three categories. The political leadership is the savvy one. They're the one who understands the importance of international legitimacy and securing funding, because they also believe in it, or elements of them, at least they do. Then you've got the military commanders, you know, the ones who are very hot-blooded, the one who are influenced heavily by Al-Qaeda and foreign fighters, this destructiveness in their mind, you know, the hate that they have towards, you know, cities, towards urban population, because their propaganda machine always injected this into their minds that everyone who lives in these cities are apostates, they're infidels, according to a Taliban sort of narrative. And then you've got the foot-level soldiers, you know, man from rural areas, often not, you know, the ones who are educated, and they have found themselves extremely confused on the streets of a city like Kabul, an urban center. I think the international community, especially the Americans and European countries, will find it very difficult to justify how they can continue funding the Taliban to their own taxpayers if the Taliban are bringing all of these rules, especially on women's education, you know, on the segregation of both genders. And this is just the beginning. We have to, like, really remember. But perhaps I sense that there is some sort of a counterterrorism relationship that exists between the Americans and the Taliban in terms of fighting against the Islamic State. That cooperation was there over the years. So that is perhaps one avenue. The second avenue is that a lot of these countries have moved their embassies to Qatar, to Doha, and Qatar's influence on the Taliban and their understanding of the Taliban, because Taliban were based there for more than 10 years, is perhaps, encouraging these Western countries that, okay, now we can use Qatar as a mediator. And we have to also really remember the lies of, countries like the U.S. in terms of their politicians publicly saying, we will never abandon Afghanistan after we withdraw the military forces. We will keep a diplomatic presence. We will continue to help Afghans. And today what we see, the Americans are saying, well, it's not safe for us to operate our embassy in Kabul. That's why we are moving the embassy to Doha. So Afghanistan will be, seen through Doha by the Americans. And that in itself tells you how dangerous the situation is to ordinary Afghans, especially to Afghan women, especially to younger Afghan men and women who don't remember the 90s. This is the 9/11 generation, young Afghans who've had access to social media, not only in Kabul and other major provincial capitals. I'd also like to think we will have to see what happens in 3 to 4 months' time to television stations like Tolo TV, to newspapers like Itlati Rose, because at the moment, a lot of their employees have been beaten up quite publicly on the streets of Kabul. And one wonders, who do you complain to if a Taliban soldier or fighter comes and beats you up? If you're tortured so badly and so publicly, who do you go and register a complaint with? But other than that, I think the failure of the Taliban to provide basic services to people, whether it's ATM machines that are running out of cash, or the country's bankrupt, or the high prices of food commodities, or the fact that Afghanistan remains literally shut to the neighborhood. Afghanistan, despite being an agricultural country, have always imported wheat and rice, at least since the 1940s and 50s. And to have an Afghanistan that is not functional under the Taliban, I think is a reality today.
Thank you so much for your time. That's Afghan journalist Bilal Sawari.